You're listening to Around Comics, episode 142. Welcome to another Monday edition of Around Comics, the comic culture podcast. I'm Christopher Niesman, and I'll be your guide for the next hour of comics news and information. Coming up on this episode, we get you ready for the week ahead with new trade paperback, single issue, and DVD releases. You'll hear my conversation with up-and-coming Marvel writer Zeb Wells. Tom Caters is back as the Answer Man. He even gets an answer from last week's segment. Scotty Young's epic three-week rant on Smallville concludes this week. We have more manga, webcomic, and movie suggestions, and in an all-new segment, John Mayo breaks down the sales and market trends inside Diamond's Top 300. All that and more is next on Around Comics. This episode of Around Comics is brought to you by Borders. Sink your teeth into the story that introduced the world to Anita Blake, Vampire Hunter. Get your copy of Guilty Pleasures by Laurel K. Hamilton at your local Borders. Borders is your home for the tastiest fantasy novels. Find a store near you at BordersStores.com. Whether you know his work from The New Warriors, Heroes for Hire, Peter Parker Spider-Man, or other titles, Zeb Wells is making an impression on comics fans. Now that he's been announced as one of the four writers that will be bringing The Amazing Spider-Man to shelves three times each month, there's no question that he's become a name to watch. And Around Comics is happy to welcome Zeb Wells. Zeb, thanks for spending some time with us tonight.
Thank you.
It was a couple months ago that it was announced that you were going to be on one of the creative teams for Marvel's three times a month relaunch of Amazing Spider-Man. What was your initial reaction when you found out you were going to be on one of those creative teams?
Oh yeah, it was definitely really exciting. You know, I didn't see it coming at all. Steve Wacker just called me out of the blue and asked if I'd be interested, and you know, probably for my benefit, acted relieved when I said yes. I have a hard time believing it was really in question whether I'd say yes or not, but it was definitely, you know, an exciting day.
Now, did you grow up as a Spider-Man fan?
Oh, definitely. I think that's, you know, because I got started because someone that lived in the basement of the house I was living in gave me a box of comics, and one of the first ones I read through was that giant-sized Spider-Man number one with the Sinister Six, which I always just loved, and there were a bunch of those from that era in there, and I just ate them up.
Now with the new series going to the three times a month, there's been, you know, a lot of people are very interested in how that entire dynamic is going to work between you and the other writers and artists. And, you know, there's been the comparisons with DC's 52 and Countdown of being, you know, a four times a month series. But I think those are all very, very different entities in how the creative teams have worked. What's been the breakdown on how the four creative teams for Amazing have been working together?
Well, it's basically, you know, Steve wants to make sure that every writer gets a chance to tell his own story. You know, you don't want it to be a situation where, you know, somebody has to finish someone else's story, or you know, like the tone of the story, the voice of the story will change right in the middle of it. So it's basically, you know, it's basically like, like a regular monthly book with an alternating creative team, except, you know, we're working far enough in advance that you'll finish an arc, and it will all come out, you know, three times a month until it's done. And so basically, it's been pretty fun because we basically just keep in touch through a conference call and emails, and we just make sure that everything is going to flow correctly from one month to the next, and also we have overarching subplots, and you know, we really wanted to bring back a cast of supporting characters, so we have to keep all of them straight. And so it's basically kind of cool because you have your own story that you're working on, but you also have like a think tank that you can throw ideas to, and the ideas get bounced around and bounced back to you.
Now, is there a lead writer to kind of keep things tied together, or is that more of an editorial?
Yeah, that's more of an editorial thing, and then just the hive mind, you know, is in charge of keeping, making sure, or guiding the direction of the book.
Now the other writers on the series, Mark Guggenheim, Dan Slott, and
Bob Gale.
Bob Gale, sure. But Back to the Future fame.
Yeah, that's right.
Who out of the other three writers have you had the most fun working with, or as you know, kind of like you said, is it just been the hive mind of all of those personalities?
Yeah, it's real. I mean, I can't, like, I know when I throw an idea out there, I usually get good feedback from everybody, you know, and then that leads to other discussions and whatnot. So, yeah, it really has been pretty even as far as who's doing what and what comes out. Like, you know, but each of them are fun to work with in their own way. You know, it's interesting because we're all from different age groups, so we're all, you know, really into Spider-Man at different periods of time, so it's kind of fun to get that, all those different perspectives on it.
Sure. Now you say different age groups, and I think that, you know, a lot of people, and rightfully so, consider you a younger writer, but you've been writing comics for a while now, and you may have the most experience writing Spider-Man of any of the group that are on the new project.
Yeah, I might. I think I've got 12 issues of Spider-Man under my belt, or, like, if you include the Doc Ock miniseries. Yeah, I think you might be right on that.
Yeah, it's dating back. When did you start writing Peter Parker Spider-Man?
I did issue 42 and 43 in 2002, and then I think my seven-issue run started in 2003, if I'm not mistaken.
Moving on from Spider-Man, because you actually do have another ongoing series that you're working on, and that is Heroes for Hire. Now, you've taken that series over from Jimmy Palmiotti and Justin Gray. I think there are obvious pressures of working on a high-profile mainstream character like Spider-Man. Does your approach to writing a team book like Heroes for Hire, where the characters are definitely known to comic fans, but not as iconic, does that change your process as a writer?
I think so. I think just the nature of the beast, you feel like you have a little more room as far as what you can do, or you can think crazier thoughts, I think. And especially, yeah, with a character like Spider-Man, just naturally, and especially being on Amazing Spider-Man, you know, you're going to feel some pressure, and obviously you're going to want to stay true to that character. But when you have, you know, yeah, so much history behind him, but then you go to characters like the ones on Heroes for Hire that have been interpreted many different ways, you know, you kind of feel more free to come with your own interpretation of the character.
We hear from a lot of different creators that will come onto a new team book, and they'll have like preconceived notions of what these characters are, but whenever they get in and start writing them, there always seems to be a surprise character that they really enjoy writing more than they thought they would have. Have you had that experience with Heroes for Hire?
Yeah, I have. I think it was, for me, it was Shang-Chi, because I just never, you know, got why that, you know, what that character was all about, you know, and I think you're right. Like, even when I started writing it, I don't think I was expecting to like him or expecting him to be anything more than, you know, because basically he'd just been running around like spouting fortune cookie phrases and stuff. And I didn't expect, you know, he really took on a life of his own, and I think I enjoy writing him the most now.
Sure. Well, whenever you get into a team book, is it really hard to split up how much time you are able to give to each character? Do you find yourself like, wow, I could write a Shang-Chi solo book, and do you have to keep yourself from letting a character take over a series like that?
Yeah, definitely. But it's kind of good because, you know, in that situation, I don't know. I think I always find that it's better to have too much stuff and have to cut stuff out and be going at it from that angle to be stuck where, you know, you're like, hey, how can I fill up a whole issue with one character, or what do I cut to? Like with a team book, and especially if you have a lot of subplots that you want to tell about, you know, you're never in the situation where you're like, what can I cut to here? You know, you've always got something to, which makes it more stressful on one hand, and then on the other hand, it makes it easier.
Heroes for Hire is not your first team book, and not your first team book at Marvel. You were creating the New Warriors with one of the members of Around Comics, Scotty Young. What was it like working on New Warriors? And you can give us some dirt too, because we want to know what the working relationship was like with Scotty.
Actually, Scotty Scotty, I think, is one of the best storytellers I've ever worked with. And I had a lot of fun there because sometimes you work with an artist where you put as much as you can into the script and you think it makes, you know, you try to make it make as much sense as far as, like, the page layout goes. But Scotty's one of those artists that he actually goes back and, thinks about the scene as well and kind of watches your back and makes sure that everything works out as it's supposed to. And then, especially with the action stuff, you know, you write some action scenes, and then when I got the artwork back from Scotty, it was super cool. You know, probably the only bad part was, you know, having to hang out with him at conventions and stuff, which can be unpleasant. And he keeps his hotel room much too cold, which I'd rather not go into why I know that.
It's frightening. I've heard stories talking about, you know, artists and artist styles. Scotty is really kind of almost jealous right now because you're getting to work with one of his idols in the industry, with Chris Bocciolo. How's that been to work with Mr. Bocciolo?
Oh, that's awesome. And yeah, it's been even better knowing how much it gets Scotty's goat, because yeah, no BS. He's been like, as far as I've known him, he's always, whenever we talk about any project we might be working on, he always finds a way to bring up Generation X and how influential that was on him. I mean, he's a huge Chris Bocciolo fanboy, so it's been, but aside from that, just being able to work with Chris Bocciolo has been awesome. I've seen one issue completed now, and it just looks awesome.
That's Scotty doesn't go fanboy very often, but whenever you bring up Bocciolo, that's one guy that gets him. That he you can tell he just there's an excitement.
Oh, yeah.
Scotty has mentioned to us in the past that when you guys were putting together the idea for New Warriors, you didn't really expect Marvel to bite on the pitch that you gave them. It seemed like you guys really were given a lot of free rein to have fun with that book.
Yeah, we were. It was one of those situations where I don't think that, you know, when the first editor, John Meskis, came and asked us to pitch it, like, I don't think it had come down from on high, you know. I don't think anyone was clamoring for a New Warriors book. And so we basically got to work on the pitch in a vacuum and just say, you know, since we had no mandate, it was just whatever we wanted to do, we threw in there. And then, yeah, somehow that thing got pushed through, and then it got put in Mackenzie Cadenhead's hand, who was definitely simpatico with what we were trying to do, and so it all just seemed to fall into place. And we got to do almost exactly what we wanted to do.
Not too long after that, the New Warriors are playing a huge role in the Marvel U, which out of your series, kind of, you know, spun, you know, the events that started Civil War. What was that? You know, was that weird to see that kind of flashpoint come out of the series that you had really kind of fostered for a few years?
Yeah, totally. We didn't know that we were just, you know, stacking logs to be thrown on the fire of Civil War, but. It was definitely interesting to see, I think it was cool. I think Scotty thought it was cool to see, like, McNiven, draw his characters, the character designs that he had come up with, and then to see Mark write the New Warriors, and, just to be, you know, obviously we can't claim much authorship over Civil War, but it was fun to see them at the beginning of it, although it was hard to see a microbe get cooked like that.
Do you get attached to characters? I know that Scotty has talked about it in the past, that there is a certain level of attachment that you get, especially when you're working on kind of the B and C list characters, that you get to really add a lot to their history and legacy.
Right. Yeah, that goes back to what I was saying. Like, you work on Spider-Man, and, you know, his voice has pretty much become what it is, and you've got to try to play within that. But then when you play with those B characters, you're really imbuing them a lot more with your voice, I think. And, yeah, you do get kind of attached to them. I mean, I you know, I'm a man. I wasn't crying when Microbe got cooked, but I might have got choked up a little.
It tugged on you just a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, now you've done some work outside of Marvel in the comics realm. You worked on Snake Woman for Virgin Comics, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was it a big difference working for Virgin as opposed to Marvel? What was that whole Virgin Comics experience like?
It was pretty similar, but that's because the reason I got that job is because Mackenzie Cadenhead, who was the editor on New Warriors, went over to Virgin shortly after, and so she brought me over. So for me, it was like just working with Mackenzie again, and so for me, I didn't really notice much of a difference.
Sure, it's not like you're going into the Marvel offices every day. You're kind of just looking at the same keyboard, kind of no matter who you're writing for, I guess.
Exactly.
Well, you're a West Coast guy, and I think that part of being on the West Coast is that, you know, you're very close to Hollywood. That has been kind of a part of your career, and you play outside of the comic book sandbox. You've done some work for Robot Chicken.
Yeah, I did. That was actually, I got that job pretty much the same way I got the Marvel job, is from those videos that I made for Wizard magazine.
You dressed up as Thor and sent it to Seth Green?
No, well, the Robot Chicken is run by Seth Green and Matthew Sunrich, that used to work at, he used to be one of the head editors at Wizard magazine. So he came out here, and yeah, for the third season they were trying like a rotating cast of writers for every five episodes. They were changing up who, like, they were bringing in a couple new writers to help them out. And so when he was coming up with who those writers were going to be, he remembered me and gave me a call.
Well, sure. Yeah. For folks that aren't aware or haven't seen it yet, you can actually go to YouTube and you've posted the Wizard Film Award film that you did, and it's the Real World Metropolis, and it's the real world with comic book characters, and it could be very easily a Robot Chicken skit. So I can see how easy a jump that was for you.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely think that's why they thought of me. And, yeah, I had a lot of fun working with those guys. Hopefully, if they do another season, I'll maybe get a chance to do it again.
We do have a couple questions here from my cohorts on the show, and you'll probably be able to figure out who a couple of them are from. If you could write any book, existing or creator-owned, what would it be, and who would you want handling the art chores?
Well, I have to say that me and Scotty worked on a Blade pitch, like a 4-issue Blade comic, which, you know, is impossible because Mark Guggenheim just did a Blade series that was really good.
Oh, it was awesome.
And, you know, yeah, and nobody bought it, so I don't think they're going to be knocking down our door anytime soon. But I will have to say that is my dream project. If me and Scotty could do that as a graphic novel or 4 issues, I would literally do it for no pay.
Wow, it's that gets me excited. I'm still angry that Blade got canceled. I thought that that Guggenheim and Chaykin did just a fantastic job with that series.
Yeah, totally. And that's the thing. You look at that, and if that couldn't make it, then I don't think Marvel will be trying again for a while. But
You see those characters in comics, and they're pretty easy to pick out. You know, the characters like Iron Fist or Moon Knight, you know, Blade, you know, that kind of type of character. They seem to have a certain amount of shelf life where Marvel will kind of keep them off to the side, and then they'll let them come out for a mini or another shot at an ongoing. And it seems like, you know, after that's done, that they go back on the shelf, and it's hard to kind of break them out of storage for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's just the business side of it. You know, you try it, and if it doesn't work, then, I mean, I guess, you know, they're trying to run a responsible business, and I guess you have to put them away for a while. Or, you know, it's hard to make it make sense financially.
What's been one of the most fun experiences writing comics for you?
I think the most fun I've had was probably the New Warriors, and not just because it was Scotty working on it, but the fact that me and Scotty got to come up with all that stuff, you know, and got to be there from the ground level, and Scotty got to color, you know, he even got to color the series, and we got to redesign the characters and everything. That was the most fun, and then I had a lot of fun working on Fantastic Four Iron Man Big in Japan, just because I thought that, you know, when they came to me with that it was going to be for Seth Fisher, and Seth Fisher is such, you know, a distinct artist, and they just asked me to make come up with a script, you know, that was as crazy as his art. So that was fun, you know, just to try to get as crazy as possible, and then to see how Seth even then, you know, managed to out-crazy me when he actually drew it was a lot of fun.
So that was a big loss for comics whenever he passed away.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Now, Sal, one of the other members of the cast here, is a huge Daredevil fan and always has been, you know, going back years. He really enjoyed your Battle and Jack Murdock miniseries, and he wanted to make sure that I asked how you decided to make Josie from Josie's Bar a real character in the Battle and Jack Murdock series.
Well, that's interesting, because the artist Carmine, he actually had pitched that. He pitched the series to Marvel, and he had already actually drawn out 4 issues of plot. Like, he had pretty much plotted out the series, and Josie was a big part of that series. And then when it came to me, like, I was brought in to restructure that, and you know, some things changed, and I restructured things so certain scenes had to be lost and brought back. But Josie was all the way through that first plot that he brought, and so I think in the original plot that he had done, he had them almost become an item, but then Jack dies before they become an item, and then I just kind of tweaked it so that they hooked up right before he died. A lot of that can be attributed to Carmine's first plot.
Do you like working with Daredevil as a character? Is he one that you could see yourself working on at some point on a regular basis?
Yeah, definitely, but yeah, he's one of those characters that, you know, the people that have worked on him before have cast such a large shadow that, you know, you don't want to just limp into a Daredevil story, that's for sure.
Yeah, those are some Titanic-sized shoes to step into anymore.
Yeah, they don't really get much bigger, so. But, I mean, that's why it was kind of fun to just play around the peripheral there. And I think I'm really grateful to Carmine for bringing that story to Marvel, and then for the editor for, you know, bringing me on, because I'm pretty proud of that story. I think we did a good job.
Looking, and I know that you're exclusive at Marvel, and congratulations on that. Do you have a lot of desire to do creator-owned work at some point in your career?
Yeah, I think at some point that would be a lot of fun. I'm thinking about that. Like, right now I'm just concentrated. I'm pretty busy at Marvel right now, but I think down the line that'd be a lot of fun.
We're really looking forward to more of your stuff. Spider-Man is—I think that's going to be an interesting experiment from Marvel. We're excited that you're going to be a part of that, and looking forward to how that all works out here in the near future.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're all definitely just—you know—I don't think it's really been done this way before. So I'm hoping it works out just as much as everyone else is.
Well, one last one here before I let you go, and Tom wanted me to ask this one. Is there any competition with the other three creative groups on Amazing to see who spins the best stories?
Oh, I think that definitely comes into play. And I mean, I know for a fact that I definitely give my scripts another once over, because you don't want to embarrass yourself in front of the guy that wrote Back to the Future or, you know, Dan Slaughter, Guggenheim. It's you want to make sure to put your best foot forward. So I don't know about them, but I'm definitely trying to embarrass them.
And it's not to make you look good, it's to embarrass them.
Exactly.
Well, Zeb, thank you so much, and know that you're welcome back anytime. I know that that Scotty would love to chat with you with the whole roundtable crew one of these days. But thanks a lot, and best of luck on the upcoming projects.
Thanks, man. Yeah, hopefully I'll be able to make it out to Chicago and say hey to Scotty sometime. I'll pop in and say hey.
Absolutely, and you know you're welcome at Dark Tower anytime, and maybe make it out for the convention next year.
Cool, man.
Zeb, you have a great night, man.
You too, man. Take it easy.
All right. Bye-bye. Let's get you ready for the week ahead with what is coming out in single issue and trade paperback releases. To start things off, here is Around Comics' very own Brian Salazar with a few of his picks on single issues that'll be hitting comic shops this week.
Hey guys, it's Sal with another look at some of the books that are coming out this Wednesday. By no means is this the complete list, it's just a few things I picked up and wanted to talk about a little bit. First up from Dark Horse, we have The Umbrella Academy Apocalypse Suite number 2. This is a book written by Gerard Way of My Chemical Romance, with art by Gabriel Ba. I love the first issue, I thought it was fantastic. If you haven't picked that up yet, I suggest go and pick it up. It's very much sort of got a Doom Patrol, Grant Morrison Doom Patrol sort of feel to it, but a little sillier, not as weird maybe, but it's very good stuff, and I highly recommend it. Interestingly enough, in 2001, Gerard Way was trying to be a comic book artist, and for whatever reason didn't break in. I don't know what his art was like, but back then, it's September 11th, the attacks of September 11th sort of changed his outlook on what he wanted to do, and he said that it really made him start the band and change his life a lot, so... interesting that turned him away from comic books to music, which has now led him back to comic books as a writer. So, next up from DC, we have Batman and the Outsiders number 1 by Tony Bedard and art by Coit Turnbull. This is the relaunch of the Batman and the Outsiders. Originally, Batman was the leader of the Outsiders and had given it up over time, and now he's back, trying to make the Outsiders sort of a strike force team for the JLA, so it should be interesting to see what happens there. Also from DC, we have The Best of the Spirit, written by Will Eisner, with art and cover by Eisner. This is a collection of 22 Spirit sections from 1940 to 1950, featuring the original work of Will Eisner, obviously. It's a trade paperback, 192 pages for $14.99. If you've never checked out the Spirit stuff, this would be a good way to maybe introduce yourself to it. One more from DC before we move on. This is Death and New Gods, number 1 of 8, from Jim Starlin, the miniseries, which will be the end of the New Gods. The New Gods, of course, were a creation of Jack Kirby's, and Starlin confirmed in an interview that this would be the end of the New Gods, saying that it's sort of the half mercy killing and a half honoring Jack, because he feels that a lot of people have, you know, sort of written the New Gods and done stuff with the New Gods since Jack Kirby, but nobody's done it very well. Moving on for Image, we have Capes Trade Paperback Volume 1 from Robert Kirkman. This is a three-issue miniseries that he had written, not miniseries, but it's a 72-page backup story from Invincible, and it's about this business that employs superpowered individuals to protect the city of New York. It's $14.99, 144 pages. I just love the Kirkman stuff in that Invincible universe. It's fun stuff. Also from Image, we have Lazarus number 1 from Juan E. Ferreira and Diego Cortez. This is a new series by them. Juan is from Rex Mundi, the creator of Rex Mundi, one of the co-creator of Rex Mundi, and this is a new series about a man who is immortal. And finally, on the list, we have Legion of Monsters hardcover from Marvel Comics. This is the all the Legion of Monsters mini one-shots that they had done, Werewolf by Night, Morbius, Man-Thing, Santana, with all the backup stuff. Plus, it has classic tales of horror and suspense featuring Scarecrow, Amphibian, and Legion of Monsters from Dead of the Night number 11, Marvel Spotlight 26, blah, 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 blah. It's a hardcover, 200 pages, $30. Also, it does include the Frankenstein story by our very own Scotty Young. So, might want to check that out. And that's it. That'll do it for this week of Future Stacks. Yes, you can call it whatever you like. And now here's Chris Marshall of the Collected Comics Library to highlight new trade paperback and collected edition releases for the week.
Okay, let's start out with DC Comics this week. And to start us off, we've got Showcase Presents World's Finest Comics Volume 1, collecting Superman 76 and World's Finest Comics 71 through 111. That, of course, is the Silver Age adventures of Superman, Batman, and Robin. We also have 52 The Companion for $20, which really reprints basically the first issues or so, or seminal storylines, of most of the major characters that were portrayed in 52, like Rip Hunter, the Metal Men, Renee Montoya, The Question, and a few other characters as well. We also have Superman Bottle City of Kandor, the trade. This collects a bunch of stories that take place within the Bottle City of Kandor, of course. Over on the Marvel side of things, really light week. Spider-Girl Volume 9, Secret Lives Digest, and Runaways Volume 7, Live Fast Digest. We are expecting two Masterworks coming out this week. The first one is Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., and The Avengers Volume 7. But both of those are not on the preliminary list as of this recording. So let's move down to Dark Horse. We've got Buffy the Vampire Slayer, The Long Way Home, which really kicks off Season 8 of the TV series in comic book form. And then in the classic department from Fantagraphic Books, we have The Complete Pogo by Walt Kelly, The Daily and Sunday Strips, Volume 1. A little bit of interesting news came out this week from Marvel, if you didn't already see it. As you know, as I reported last week, we've been waiting 11 months for the Powers Volume 10 Cosmic trade to come out, and it did come out, and boy, it came out with a bang. The spine of the book was actually misspelled. It was spelled COSIMIC, Cosimic. And as you can guess, it's created quite a stir this week over just about all the message boards that feature collected editions. There was an apology written by C.B. Cebulski on this over at the Bendis boards. And if you want to read the whole thing, just go to my website, collectedcomicslibrary.com. And scroll down, you'll see it. And you'll see a picture of the mishap, which you can get a nice large view. Or you can just go to your local comic book store and pick up a copy and look on the spine. It's rather funny and sad at the same time. So that's it for this week. I definitely didn't expect it to be this light. So for Around Comics, I'm Chris Marshall, Collected Comics Library.
Chris Marshall is the host of the Collected Comics Library podcast. You can find the podcast, release schedules, and checklists of everything collected at collectedcomicslibrary.com.
Welcome back to Answer Man. It is 3 a.m. on a Sunday morning. I've just been to a birthday party. We ran out of beer. It turns out it's very hard to buy alcohol at 2 in the morning in Chicago. There's no 30 packs to be had in the entire Bucktown neighborhood. So, I cut the evening short to come back home. And since it was a birthday party, I've sort of had a lot of wistful thinking about identity and masochism. And that leads directly to the question that I'm going to answer today. When I decided to start doing this, where I was going to solicit questions from people, I immediately knew there was going to be a question that someone was going to ask. that someone was going to challenge me with and really come after me. Because there's one ultimate question in comic books, especially for a DC fan. And I'm going to answer that tonight because I'm feeling it. I'm feeling the energy. I'm feeling like I can really, you know, go after it. I can give you what you want. Or I could fail completely, and that's what this is about. This is about me just tossing stuff out there, and sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. So, here it goes. This is from Villainy, which is a very clever email name, and he asks, explain Hawkman's continuity. Seriously, I'm confused. Well, here's the thing with Hawkman. It is extremely confusing, and it becomes even more confusing the more you look into it. So I'm just going to give you the explanation off the top of my head that makes it work for me. What you had was the 1940s JSA Hawkman, which was the one that took place back in World War II, who was an archaeologist by the name of Carter Hall, who discovers nth metal, discovers the wings, does all that. It's very simple. You have the Silver Age Hawkman, which was an alien by the Thanagarian from the world Thanagar called Qatar Hall, who was sort of an intergalactic police officer who, gets sent to Earth and, gets involved with the Justice League and all of that. And so you have those two characters, and immediately, just from the explanation I've given you, you can see where the confusion has always laid around this character, is the fact that they never did a really good job of separating the Golden Age character from the Silver Age character. They had different costumes, but they had a lot of similarities. Their names sounded extremely similar, even though their origins are completely different. They had similar sounding names. Character-wise, just the way they interacted with people, the Silver Age Hawkman never had that much of a unique personality, so he sort of gets lumped in with that. And then every time DC Comics had one of their big continuity-changing events, like Crisis on Infinite Earths, and they had an opportunity to present the Unified Hawkman, they always kind of fucked it up. Crisis on Infinite Earths, immediately afterwards, Hawkman, which is the Qatar Hall, the alien Hawkman, has a certain, sort of dickishness about him. Which, if you've been reading my JLA blog, that seems to be a common character trait. He has a sort of certain character trait for about 2 years afterwards, and then when they relaunched Hawkman, they sort of changed the character a little bit, which was very confusing because he was interacting with other characters who had just been sort of reset. So there's a lot of confusion about that character. He disappeared during Zero Hour, I believe, and overall, they never, didn't really resolve it, which, in the new history of combining everything, which was the true origin. Which leads me to, already confusing, leads me to the, one of the best things I've ever read in comics, was Geoff Johns' explanation of how Hawkman is what he is. In the JSA series, the literal JSA series by Geoff Johns, he wrote a story called The Return of Hawkman, which explains that Hawkman is sort of a reincarnated alien mixed with an Egyptian prince, mixed with all this stuff. What he did is he set forth the precedent that when Hawkman dies, he comes back. And when he comes back, it's always a little bit different. But also, tying that all together has made it so that sort of all the versions of Hawkman you've seen kind of work. The same Hawkman that was the Golden Age Hawkman was the Silver Age Hawkman, which was all that. It's just, it gave it a very loose way to sort of say that every Hawkman you can think of is all sort of fits together. Now, if you start really looking at it really closely, it's going to fall apart. With like a lot of things in comics, you start analyzing it too much, and you take sort of the creativity out of it, and you sort of kill it. And Hawkman's the ultimate example of this. Hawkman can be a great character, especially interacting with other characters, but if you really want to make a timeline of this character, it's going to be confusing. So my advice is, do not even think about the actual origin of Hawkman, or, which Hawkman's correct. Pick the one you like and stick to it. This actually ties into another question that I received recently, which I think this is a really great opportunity to talk about this. This is an email from one Mr. Brent, I'm not going to say his last name. He asks, I just recently got into comics, and something has been bugging me about continuity and timing. Immortal Iron Fist, for instance, takes Danny Rand to Kunlun for a tournament between the Seven Cities, while New Avengers has Danny heading to New York to assist the Mighties. My question is, which comes first in the life of Danny Rand? Does Immortal come before New Avengers? Does this sort of thing work, one character in two simultaneous books? It can, in fact, work. It's tricky, though. And just like with Hawkman, if you start looking at timelines or you start looking at things too close in detail, you sort of... it starts unraveling. The way I've always looked at it is when you look at like a solo book of a character, it's written differently. It's written to showcase just that character. And oftentimes events, you know, six issues of a book could realistically take place over one day. So if you're stuck up on that timeline situation, you can think of the fact that, you know, the events that take place in New Avengers, you know, the last arc, could take place over like a week. You know, the events in Iron Fist can take place over a day. But you also, I think you're better served almost by developing like a thick skin attitude towards time. There's so many times when you're going to be reading a comic book and the time is going to seem, you know, amorphous or confusing, or it's not going to make sense. How can Wolverine be in every, you know, Marvel book? How can Batman be in, you know, these four different Batman stories going on and be in the Justice League? And the way you have to look at it, and the way it's always worked for me, is look at the goals of the book. Like I said, a solo book is going to showcase just that character. A team book, you know, like New Avengers or a book like JLA, isn't so much hung up on that, just that one character. And so it's not out of continuity, but you kind of have to take it for what it is, and you kind of have to accept that it's realistic for these characters to have all these, you know, different things going on all at the same time. It used to bother me a lot, and eventually as I sort of read more and more and I sort of let go of that and sort of embraced the fun part of it. I mean, that to me is one of the things that can kind of kill the fun of comics, is you read a book and you start focusing too much on time, or you start focusing too much on, you know, how does this origin fit with that origin, instead of just looking literally at the book that's in front of you. And one of the biggest things that I always want people to walk away from when I talk to them about comic books is, you know, it's more than a Wikipedia entry, it's more than a timeline, it's more than like an Excel spreadsheet. It's supposed to be an entertaining story. It's supposed to be a little piece of pop art. And I think embracing that frees you up to really enjoy a lot of different things, and you find yourself sort of not worrying so much about the little stuff, like the timeline stuff. And I think it helps you just enjoy the hobby more. And that's it. I'm done. I'm surprised. I was debating doing this either now or in the morning before the Packer game. And I had to do one of the two because I'm a horrible procrastinator, which I'm sure the more of these I do and the more you hear me talk about what time I'm doing it, you'll find out that I'll do them really late at night, or I'll sound really tired. I thought I was going to sound really tired, but hopefully I got more excited as I went on. And I'm happy I did it now, because I that was fun to do that. And, you know, if you want me to answer your questions, if you're hung up on something, if you're pissed that in 1973 the Flash keeps mentioning that it's 1973 and it's driving you insane, you want me to quell your fears and, you know, and just sort of hold you, you know, audio-wise, you know, not physically. I can't come to you and, you know, hold you, but I can do this. I can use my voice and wrap around you and tell you it's going to be okay, and you're going to have fun with it. And that's it. The Answer Man just wants you to have fun. So if you have any questions for me, always feel free to send them to tom@roundcomics.com. I love you. Bye.
Around Comics is proud to help support the Hero Initiative. Hero creates a financial safety net for yesterday's creators who need emergency medical aid, financial support for essentials of life, and an avenue back into paying work. It's a chance for all of us to give back something to the people who have given us so much enjoyment. For more information, visit www.heroinitiative.org or call 310-909-7809. Twice a month, John Mayo breaks down the sales numbers and market trends to give us a more informed idea of what's happening on the business side of comics. This week, John takes a look at the numbers inside Diamond's Top 300.
Here is a breakdown of the sales of the top 300 comics to retailers through Diamond during August 2007. Please note that these numbers are based on what shipped to retailers and not based on sales to consumers. An estimated total of 7,687,000 comics are sold to retailers, which is up by 43,000 copies from the previous month of July and up by 286,000 copies from August 2006. This equates to an estimated value of $24,623,000 at full cover price, which is an increase of $604,000 from the previous month of July. DC Comics came in at 38.44% of the total sales for the top 300 comics in August, with 94 different items on the list. DC sales totaled to an estimated 2,955,000 copies. The top-selling item for DC Comics was Justice League of America number 12 in slot 2 with an estimated 131,000 copies. This was up 8,600 copies from the previous issue. Marvel Comics had 49.31% of the total sales for the top 300 comics in August, with 98 different items on the list. Marvel sales were estimated at 3,790,000 copies to retailers. The top-selling item for Marvel Comics was World War Hulk number 3 in the top slot, with an estimated 152,000 copies, down 11,500 copies from the previous issue. Image Comics accounted for 2.9% of the total sales of the top 300 comics in August and had 22 different items on the list. The top-selling item for Image Comics was Spawn 170 in slot 106 with an estimated 23,700 copies, a decrease of 300 copies from the previous issue. One interesting move on the charts was Teen Titans number 50 in slot 28, with an increase of an estimated 10,400 copies, which was the biggest increase in sales over the previous issue for the month, resulting in an estimated 69,600 copies sold. For Around Comics, this is John Mayo.
John Mayo writes the Mayo Report each month, which examines the sales estimates and market trends for comic book, graphic novels, and collected editions. He's also the host of the Comic Book Page podcast. You can find his article at comicbookresources.com and his podcast and sales estimates charts at comicbookpage.com. Comics aren't just in comic shops and bookstores anymore. Now you can find literally thousands of webcomics online. Jeremy Mullins is here to save you hours of searching on the internet by telling us where to find the best and brightest in the ever-changing world of webcomics.
Thanks, Christopher. This week's recommended webcomic is The Perry Bible Fellowship by cartoonist Nicholas Gurich. If you're a fan of the unhinged humor of Gary Larson's Far Side, go ahead and consider Perry Bible Fellowship its amped-up, awesome, power metal-loving younger brother. Gurich's art style varies dramatically from strip to strip. Like the featured topics, no materials seem forbidden. Sometimes figures look like doughy-looking vector art. Other times the creator uses paint, charcoal, color pencil, watercolors, whatever, to summon forth a ridiculous landscape of texture, color, detail, and buffoonery. I look at it and it's like, what if Dr. Strange and Papa Smurf had a bastard kid? I've tried to describe some of my favorite strips in previous takes of this segment. Bump that. They're fucked up. Pull up pbfcomics.com and take a look for yourself. The web address one more time, pbfcomics.com. You don't have to just trust my stamp of approval. Gurich has received multiple major awards for the Perry Bible Fellowship, including the Ignatz Award for Outstanding Online Comic in 2005 and 2006, and he also won the Webcomic Cartoonist Choice Award for Outstanding Comic 2 years in a row. Recently, Gurich won the Harvey Award for Best Online Comics Work. PBF is updated, albeit irregularly, on Wednesdays, but you can also find it in print. If you go to Amazon.com, you can order The Trial of Colonel Sweeto and Other Stories, a collection of comic strips of the Perry Bible Fellowship published by Dark Horse Comics. For Around Comics, I'm Jeremy W. Mullins.
Jeremy Mullins is a professor of sequential art at the Savannah College of Art and Design. You can find more about the school and their programs of study at www.scad.edu. From the bowels of hell to your bookshelf, the Teddy Scares return in a third all-new sad, viciously humorous volume. Teddy Scares Volume 3 includes the heartbreaking origin of Edwin Morose, the arrival of Eli Retch, and Super Cyrus, the even stupider alter ego of Abnormal Cyrus. Based on the popular toy line and featuring art from some of the industry's most promising new and established talent, Teddy Scares Volume 3 is a must-have for any fan of dark humor. For previews of Teddy Scares Volume 3 and tons of other Ape Entertainment goodness, visit our friends at www.apecomics.com. Sometimes reading your comic books backwards can be a good thing. And to prove just that, here is Jarrett Williams to give his manga pick of the week.
This week I had the pleasure of picking up a book that I've been meaning to read for a long time now called My Dead Girlfriend by Eric White. The book came out Valentine's Day of this year, and I'm reviewing it now because I will say it's probably one of the standout titles from Tokyo Pop this year. To give you a quick synopsis of the story, you're dealing with the Bleak family, this family who's over the past, I guess, say, centuries have had these outrageous deaths. Flash forward now, you deal with Finney Bleak, who's pretty much waiting for his moment to encounter, you know, death. And I mean outrageous death. So within the first couple of pages, you get to experience some of the things his family members have gone through. And I would say that first chapter was probably one of my favorites in the book, just for how comedic it was. I mean, it had some really nice laugh out loud moments. Finney is an interesting kid. You know, he's your average teenage character. He goes to this school, though, called Mephisto Prep, which is full of werewolves and mummies or whatnot. And, I mean, this morbid cast. All the cliques are there. Anything you expect in sort of a high school drama is there. But I will say that White handled a lot of it in such a comedic way. It was really fun for me to read. And you sort of know where the story's going. Finney meets this girl at a carnival named Jenny, and as the name implies of the book, she dies. And it's just cool to see how that little love story plays out between those two throughout the book. It's a really quick read. You'll get through it in only a matter of minutes to an hour at the most. The art style really carries it along really fast. It's sort of like watching a cartoon and stuff in, you know, comic book format. That's how really solid White's artwork is. He has some great expressions. I loved some of the chapters dealing with Finney and his family, and I'm really looking forward to see where this series progresses to. I was looking online to see if Volume 2 was in the works or what's going on with that, but here's hoping that Volume 2 to My Dead Girlfriend comes out. I'm really excited to see where the series goes. An added bonus, too, is in the back you have, you know, a great art gallery by several artists, which I enjoyed, as well as seeing White's preliminary artwork for My Dead Girlfriend. So, I mean, you have a pretty solid package here. Definitely check it out. You probably could find it anywhere now. Again, I'm a couple months late on it, but definitely check out My Dead Girlfriend. It's a solid read.
When Jarrett Williams isn't reading manga, he is pursuing his MFA in sequential art at the Savannah College of Art and Design. And you can read more of his various stories at www.lunarboyland.com.
All right, we're back with the last installment of our rant on Smallville, a show that makes it seem like Beauty and the Geek is a good idea. Speaking of Clark and his gear, does anybody wonder why you'll see one character wearing, you know, like a tube top and a skirt, and Clark is still wearing his goddamn Carhartt jacket? I mean, really? Do we need to be hammered home that Clark Kent is Superman? We are not as retarded as Lois Lane. You do not need to fucking baste us every 5 seconds with the Superman colors. We know that he will become Superman. Now, we've introduced the new character, right? Jimmy Olsen. We've brought him in finally. And I think that the producers of the show really, really went out into the world of actors and really stretched themselves and found somebody who really fit the role, and that's Aaron Ashmore, which shouldn't be at all weird that his fucking twin brother, Sean Ashmore, already played a villain on the show for multiple seasons. But hey, you know what? They're not the same actor. Technically, we're good. I know that they look fucking identical, but that's okay. This is Jimmy Olsen. The other guy was a fucking villain, stole Superman's fucking powers. Don't worry about it. Well, you didn't notice that. Again, you're all Lois Lane. You're all fucking retarded. That's another one. Writers sitting in the room, producers sitting in the room, laughing their fucking asses off. Now, again, I haven't finished the whole season yet, but plastered all over the DVD boxes is, you know, that sweet Michael Bay-style shot of the Justice League walking away from an explosion, which I'll tell you what, man, I'm so excited to get to that episode where we got all of the Justice League, all these random kids that have come together. I see that Aquaman now has an official costume prior to the last season when he just had, you know, some swimming trunks and way too overly developed shoulders swimming through the water. But now he has the Aquaman costume. So the Justice League episode is something that really I've probably been waiting for my whole life, because it is kind of the culmination of everything awesome in the world. So we'll see what happens when I get to that one. Maybe I'll do a rant on just that episode alone. The one saving grace to this show is Allison Mack, who plays Chloe Sullivan. I would do terrible, terrible, dirty, dirty things to Chloe Sullivan. I just can't help it. Not necessarily the reporter side of Chloe, but I think there's a freak in the evening somewhere inside Chloe.
She was really a nasty freak. She just loved to get down with sex all the time. She was like, any time of day, she was like, yeah, let's go. I'm so nasty, and I'd be nailing her. Oh, shit. She'd be like, oh, you're nailing me. Cool.
She's just so short and blonde and got the thick little, oh, motherfucker. Oh, so, yeah. Chloe, you probably saved me from killing myself, drowning myself in the tub, throwing myself off my porch, all these things from watching the show. You are the one that brings it back down for me. More screen time for Chloe Sullivan. All right, overall, you know what? I really can't figure out why I'm still watching this fucking show. I want to take the razor blades, want to slit the wrists, yet I hit next when the episode's over and I move on to the next one. It's like I have some naive desire to watch and watch and hope that this show changes and gets better. I don't know why I believe that will happen. Maybe it's the crazy comic book fan in me that will stick with something years past its time, but oh, it's the same characters, I gotta still buy it, doesn't matter the quality. So, you know, I don't know why other people still watch it. I can't figure out why the network still airs it. At this point, it is a fucking train wreck that I feel stupid for watching, and I will probably keep watching for a long time to come. So guess what? I'm just as fucking retarded as the show.
When he's not writing the continuing adventures of Catwoman, Will Pfeiffer is a DVD and movie reviewer for the Rockford Register-Star. Here's Will to tell us about what's happening in DVDs this week.
First up, a few noteworthy releases that will be hitting store shelves on Tuesday. Continuing the Halloween theme of recent weeks, we've got the Amityville collection, which includes Amityville 1, 2, and of course, 3D. No word on if you get a free pair of goofy glasses or not. Of slightly more recent vintage is the director's cut of Hollow Man, the 2000 Paul Verhoeven movie. If you've ever dreamed about seeing, or not seeing, an invisible Kevin Bacon sexually assault someone, here's your big chance. Also, an ape vanishes right before your eyes. You don't want to miss that. Transformers makes a surprisingly quick trip to DVD, allowing moviegoers whose eyes couldn't keep up with the CGI action to finally make some sense of the movie with their remote controls. The other half of Grindhouse, Robert Rodriguez's Planet Terror, also lands on disc, with plenty of gore, blood, testicles in a jar, and Rose McGowan with a machine gun for a leg. Now that, my friends, is entertainment. Look for the entire Grindhouse double feature to be collected, as soon as everyone buys both movies separately. Finally, if you're looking for true horror this Halloween season, look no further than the new DVD of Jingle All the Way, Arnold Schwarzenegger's 1996 Yuletide epic. Be sure to watch for Jake Lloyd, aka Little Darth Vader, playing the Terminator's kid. For this week's cult DVD pick, I'm recommending 42nd Street Forever, a collection of vintage movie trailers from Synapse Video. These are the sort of movies you could catch during the glory days of Times Square sleaze, if you were lucky. Instead of describing them, I'll just list a few titles. The Undertaker and His Pals, I Dismember Mama, The Three Dimensions of Greta, Werewolves on Wheels, They Call Her One Eye, Shocking Asia, Death Will Have Your Eyes, Behind Convent Walls, and of course, the gay biker classic, The Pink Angels. The disc has dozens of these clips, and though most of the movies are so bad you never want to sit through them, watching the fast-paced, sign-the-thrill trailers is entertaining and educational. Trust me, you never realize movies can be so damn crazy. So that's it for this week's DVD scene. I'm Will Pfeiffer for Around Comics.
You can find Will's written reviews at the Rockford Register Star by visiting go.rrstar.com and going to the entertainment section. You can also visit Will's blog at willpfeiffer.com. And that'll take care of another Monday edition of Around Comics, the Comic Culture Podcast. Make sure to come back on Thursday for Around Comics, the Comic Culture Roundtable. It's an informal and entertaining roundtable discussion about the world of comics and pop culture. You can visit us online at aroundcomics.com. You can contact the show via email at info@aroundcomics.com. You can also visit us at MySpace and ComicSpace. And if you like the show, you can leave a review at the iTunes Music Store. I want to thank you for listening today and making Around Comics your source for comic book news, reviews, and opinions. We'll be back again next Monday for another edition of the Comic Culture Podcast. In the meantime, we'll be everywhere in and around comics. Views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Any reproduction, retransmission, or rebroadcast without the express written consent of Around Comics is strictly prohibited. All content presented in this program is the sole property of Around Comics, and this has been an Around Comics production, copyright 2007.
Try my loving, baby, one more time. Try my loving, baby, one more time. Oh, you got my loving good. Now you're gonna love me all alone. Why you got my loving, left me alone? Why you got my left alone? I know that you don't love me. one more time. Oh, baby, love him. Oh, baby, I love you, I love you, love me, baby, yeah.